Hey, this is Rocky. You're listening to the Yo Rocco podcast. Today I'm talking to Eric Clark. Eric is the author of the Lectionaric video series on YouTube. These are weekly videos that he started recording based on lectionary scripture texts, but in conversation with novels and films and other pieces of pop culture that are really interesting, really thought-provoking, a little bit edgy. And we had a great conversation about why he's using video, who his audience is, what he's trying to really do well with these. And I think you're going to really like it. So here's Eric. All right. So Eric, you were just saying?
I'm not sure we've ever actually spoken together, but other than on Facebook.
I'm pretty sure we haven't, actually. We know a lot of the same people, and our paths, you know, overlap at several different places with different people and different kinds of work. But I've known about your work with Two Friars and a Fool for a long time, and just recently came across this lectionary thing and couldn't pass up the chance to talk to you. So it's good to meet you, I guess.
Yeah, good to meet you as well. All right. I think we both have a good mutual friend in Landon Whitsitt.
Indeed.
So we can spend some time mocking him together. That'll be good.
That's always fun to do. He was on the podcast maybe a month ago. He was my second guest, and I had him on talking about music. So what I've been doing with this podcast is talking to people whose work in the church, it's been mostly people in the church, is interesting to me. And the common thread with all the people that I've talked to is that they're all, so far they've all been pastors, but the work I'm talking to them about is not their pastoral call so much as some side project that they're working on. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
So I talked to Landon about he's writing music. I talked to Casey Fitzgerald about her storytelling podcast that she started. And so as soon as I saw Lection Eric, I thought, man, this would be a great project for me to talk to him about. So I appreciate you taking the time and being willing to talk to me about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But before we do that, I want to ask you about your post this morning on Facebook about finishing Around the World in 80 Days with your kids.
Yeah. So me and my boys, I have two sons, 10 and 7 years old, and they are both voracious readers on their own. And I wanted, there were a bunch of books that I really enjoyed as a kid and that are not necessarily the books that you pick up without someone encouraging you to pick it up, right. older books and stuff. And I thought it'd be fun for us to read together. So, I mean, we started with Harry Potter. We read the first Harry Potter together. But I don't want my younger boys, really, he's only 7. I didn't want to, like, rush through the Harry Potters and read, like, some of the darker, older Harry Potters when he's 7 years old. So I had to space them out. So I filled those with some other books that we wanted to read. And we picked up some Jules Verne novels, and I offered them a selection of Jules Verne novels, and they picked Around the World in 80 Days to read. So we read it. We read like a chapter or two each evening together out loud, and we just finished it last night. It was awesome.
And were they as enthused by it as you are?
Yeah, I mean, we had to take it slow and like give them lots. There's lots of vocabulary in it that they, you know, they would they could just interrupt and say, "What's that word mean?" or "What's going on here?" But they loved it, and I was surprised. I mean, I don't know if I've ever actually even read Around the World in 80 Days before. I knew the story. I think I saw a movie when I was a kid, but I was surprised how action-packed and how exciting the book was. And, you know, it really is pretty fast-paced. There's a lot going on.
Yeah. Well, that's a good suggestion. I'm doing the same thing with my daughter who's 6, and maybe you can give me some advice on this. I never read the Harry Potter books when they came out, and so we're actually reading them. And she is like a completely absorbed in the Harry Potter thought world. And we're 2 chapters into the 5th book, The Order of the Phoenix. And yeah, so the 4th one is pretty dark. You know, there's a main character who dies, and, you know, I'm watching her for signs of distress, right? Or, because she is only 6, and I don't know what's coming. And there are parts where I will actually just sort of read ahead a paragraph or two and summarize for her what's happening and spare the descriptions.
Right.
But the funny thing is that she doesn't get troubled by the quote-unquote scary stuff as much as she gets freaked out by the scenes where there's just a lot of tension, right? So So there's a scene in, I think it's in the 4th one where like Harry is hiding under the invisibility cloak on the stairs, and Snape and Mad-Eye Moody are talking about him and he could be found out, and she was begging with me to stop and like to skip ahead. Like, she couldn't stand the tension of that. And I was like, no, you have to go through this. You can't skip this stuff.
It's fascinating how they react, isn't it? Yeah, I've noticed, like, my older son is mostly, he responds fairly predictably to the parts I would think you'd respond to. But my younger son, he's really, like, it's like when people are, when people who are supposed to like each other are mad at each other, that really bothers him. When friends fight, or when when couples have troubles or they break up, or if we're watching a movie or anything, the music, he triggers to the music. If there's scary music or if there's like sad music, he immediately responds to that. I mean, you could put whatever gore you want on the screen and he's like, yeah, whatever, rolls his eyes. But if you put in some scary music, he'll freak out. So it's really interesting.
That is really interesting. Well, So we're on the fifth book, and I'm ready for there to need to be some spots that we skip or things, because it's you can just feel the tenor of the thing getting a little bit more dark. And I don't have any experience with this. I've never read these books, and I've never raised a 6-year-old before. But
right. So yeah. Well, they do grow up with Harry, right? You know, they do. Each year he's a little older, and the story's a little more mature as well. And of course the broad story is the story of, you know, the fight with Voldemort, and so that story, of course, is also leading toward its climax, which is therefore becomes tenser and darker.
Right, and we're watching the movies as we read the book, so we'll finish a book and then we'll watch the movie of that. And Common Sense Media, do you ever use that tool?
Mm-mm.
So it's a website that does ratings for movies and reviews of movies for parents. So it'll give like a age-appropriate rating for each of the movies. And like the first two Harry Potters.
I know a Movie Mom, but I hadn't heard of Common Sense. That's awesome.
Well, that's funny. I've never heard of Movie Mom. the first two movies, it assigns an age of like, I think, 8. But after that, all the rest of them, it's like 12 and over. And so she's 6 and she's watched them all. Again, you know, I'm watching her reaction. So like in the fourth one, when Voldemort shows up and you actually see his face and it's really freaky, like, she's not bothered by that at all.
Right.
It's strange.
Yeah, I mean, and my boys, you know, saw like the Star Wars movies and the Lord of the Rings movies when they were like 3 and 4 years old, and people told me that was too young, and some of the things I had no control over, like grandparents showed them, and everyone seems to have different ideas about what the appropriate age is, and I guess it's just, you know, watch your kid and make sure that they are responding okay and take care of them, and you know?
And I think books are you can definitely take books further than you can take movies. I think as a parent, like, I'll expose my kid to a scary book far more easily than a scary movie. And so, and maybe you're the same way. I mean, you're a book guy, right? You're a literary guy.
Yeah.
Is that? I mean, when the Lectionaric project, you are using references to other novels and other books to inform your reading of these gospel texts. Is that just a part of what you've always done? What's your literary background?
Yeah, I mean, well, so I myself have always been a voracious reader. I really love reading fiction. As an adult, I've read a lot of nonfiction as well, but I still read a lot of fiction, primarily science fiction and fantasy, but also young adult novels, mysteries, classic literature. It varies in what I really engage with. And I think that Salman Rushdie wrote a great children's book called Harun and the Sea of Stories. Have you ever heard of it?
I haven't.
Okay, it's really good. Really, really, really good. I would put it on your list and definitely read it your little one someday. But basically the concept behind Harun and the Sea of Stories is that all stories kind of swim in this sea of common human ideas and archetypes, and they share these ideas, and they use these ideas. It's like a common treasury of story, and I mean, I think that's basically true. I think that stories, you know, Joseph Campbell's idea that they're sort of archetypal mythological paths, characters, heroes that form, I think that's true, and I think that's just as true of scripture as it is of other stories. So we can look to patterns in the stories and archetypes in the stories as ways to help us interpret and understand them and add richness and add depth when we see that there's similarities between the ways that the gospel writers are writing about Jesus and the way that, you know, fantasy writers write about their characters or epic poems write about their characters or whatever, that doesn't diminish the gospel or any other story. It just, like, reinforces its richness and adds new layers of meaning.
For some people, it would be threatening, though, right? I mean, I was a literature major in college at an evangelical Christian college, and I had classmates for whom that was a very threatening idea, that the Gospels and that Scripture shares certain literary traits with literature all over the world, like from the beginning of storytelling. Mm-hmm. They would claim that sort of diminishes the uniqueness of Scripture, and I still encounter people who look at Scripture that same way, but that's not your view at all.
No, that isn't my view. I mean, I guess I would compare it to some people think that there's one soulmate out there for them, and that one person, they have to magically find them, and if they don't, they'll live alone in misery.
Yeah, I encountered that in college a lot too.
And I think that idea is, honestly, I think it's unhealthy. I think it's a bad romantic idea. I think that the truth is that healthy relationship takes work, and there's not a magic formula, and if you meet the right person, it doesn't guarantee a long relationship. And there's probably multiple people out there that with time and patience and effort you could have a healthy relationship with. The question isn't whether or not you found the right person. The question is whether or not you are going to work hard, and both of you are going to work hard to make this relationship work.
Well, that's not romantic at all.
I know, that doesn't sound romantic, but to me, actually, I think in some ways it's more romantic because it means that Stacia, my wife, who I love immensely, I love by choice. I'm not loving because, you know, the stars aligned and the planets forced me to, or in Twilight fashion, some supernatural compulsion that I have to mate with this person. No, this is a person that I've chosen to spend my time with, and not only did I choose once upon a time, but I have to continually choose to spend my time with. I think that's excellent. And so in a similar way, I think that stories, having to have the gospel be utterly unique as a story, it's kind of immature. It kind of says that we don't trust that we can find value here and by choosing to find value here and by looking for the value that it has rather than by assuming, but then having to artificially set it on a pedestal above and beyond all other stories.
Yeah.
And in that way, I think you have to actually do sort of intellectual harm to yourself because you have to sort of refuse to look at the richness of other stories. You have to exclude them from your view in order to maintain the false belief that the gospel is unique.
And you never are allowed to ask what the biblical story looks like from the perspective of those other stories.
Right, yeah.
Which is a really challenging question.
Exactly.
But there are parts of the biblical story, in particular the gospel narratives, that subvert the conventions of the hero narrative, for example, to come back to Joseph Campbell.
Definitely.
And personally, I kind of hang my hat on those. I mean, those are the moments that as a preacher, like, you really want to explain to people, this is how this story is supposed to go, but here is how, with the Jesus story, it takes an unexpected turn or it subverts the convention.
Absolutely. In fact, I think the most crucial subversion of the convention basically is that Jesus doesn't beat his enemies with superior strength or skill. It does everything. It puts the confrontation in, you know, it builds to the climax, at which point Jesus should win, and Jesus does the opposite. And that's and does it in a, you know, the bad guys of the story win on their terms, you know, right. I think it's still fair to describe the cross as a victory in theological language, but in terms of just sort of story narrative, the bad guys want to kill Jesus. They do kill Jesus. They don't suffer any repercussions for having done that. That is more or less, they got what they wanted. They win.
Right.
Jesus choosing to be vulnerable, choosing to risk. I mean, he's not Superman. He's not Indiana Jones. He's not, Luke Skywalker. He's not any of these heroes that, you know, used strength and skill and power to overcome the bad guys. And yeah. And that's important. But interestingly, you can't see that unless you set it against all the other stories and compare it to the other stories. So in a way, even the subversion, it is important, like, to compare the stories. It works as subversion because we're so used to the other kinds of stories.
And you're really adept at bringing those other kinds of stories, particularly popular ones that have a lot of currency today, and using those as an entry point into the gospel stories. That's kind of what you're doing with the lectionary videos, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, what my goal is with lectionary, I have several goals with lectionary, but what I like to do and what is something that I feel is sustainable, I can do on a regular basis, is to take scripture and bounce it against novels and movies and, you know, pop culture, other elements of stories in our culture, and just kind of see what shakes out. What interesting overlaps are there? What interesting contrasts are there? And what ways does it help us see scripture afresh? Or what ways does scripture help us see our culture afresh? See our stories that we're telling. Because in a lot of ways, I think a lot of people actually are more informed and more formed by pop culture than they are by scripture.
No doubt.
Yeah. So if sometimes I think the great thing about smashing scripture up against pop culture is to help people sort of start to critically analyze pop culture. What is it that our movies and our television shows and stuff are telling us? What are they teaching us? Because even when they don't have intentional pedagogy, there's a you know, a subconscious and unintentional pedagogy to any story. So yeah, what are we absorbing unintentionally by absorbing these kinds of stories?
And that's clearly really energizing for you. Like, that's kind of where you live, is that intersection of scriptural reading and reading of popular culture. But who's the audience for Lectionary? Who do you envision really using these?
Mm-hmm. So I have three groups sort of in mind. I mean, the one group, and I always try and keep this. This is just the biggest and broadest group. I always try and keep this in mind when I make a video, is just the internet itself. And the reason I say that, as opposed to, say, a particular, like, a identifiable demographic, like, people in the church or 20, 30-year-olds or something, is because I haven't seen a lot of Christian content being produced specifically for the internet. Video. I mean, there's a lot of text. There's a lot of blogs and a lot of writing and a lot of text online, but there's not a lot of video. And the reason the video that there is out there is video content that was created for other purposes that just got put online accidentally, like sermons, which were, you recorded a sermon that the sermon was for the church, but then you also put the sermon online and other people who want to view it can view it. Right. But it wasn't intended for an internet audience. Or seminars or lectures or things like that. A lot of that kind of stuff gets put online by Christians. But the internet, the content that's put on the internet that's specifically for the internet by Christians is either theologically abhorrent to me, or, you know, just really simple or not very good quality content. And that sounds terribly critical. But there just isn't. If you go on YouTube and you search Christian videos, there's just not much.
You're talking about
slim pickings.
The still shot of the sunset over the scrolling lyrics to How Great Thou Art. Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Like, I mean, that kind of stuff, which is like, it's fine. Mostly that stuff I actually think is just the internet's more like being used as a cloud to store it so that you can play it in worship. It isn't really like intended for people online who are searching for something interesting to watch or to share in social media or to put on Reddit. It isn't intended for them to consume. And so I wanted to make content which was intended for the internet, which was intended to be watched online, like the Vlogbrothers video series or CGP Grey or ViHeart or any of the other great YouTubers that are doing content that's really, it's intended for people online to watch and to share.
Right. So the Vlogbrothers is a really obvious influence for you.
Absolutely.
I'm not a huge YouTube subscriber. I went through a phase about a year and a half ago where I subscribed to all these YouTube channels of different comedy troupes. And then I just realized trying to keep up with what they were all producing was really wearing me out. And so I don't you're probably the main subscription that I actually, over the last month or so, have checked in on a regular basis. So the Vlogbrothers and those other ones you named, I've never even heard of before. But what is it that they do? Like, what are the conventions of a really good online video to make it stick with an internet audience? What do you have to do well?
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm still learning, but the basic rules are, you know, 4 to 5 minutes, can't be long, fast-paced, no silence. There's no time for silence on the internet.
truer words were never spoken. There's no time for silence on the internet.
Right, there just isn't. And that, of course, as, you know, as spiritual people, as Christians, that's something we might want to criticize. But there's a pause button. You know, if people need to go back and hear something I said again, or they want to, if I say something that strikes them as challenging or profound and they want to think it over, they can pause it. But having long silence in a video is really awkward. So 4 to 5 minutes, really fast paced. You want to jam it full of content, a lot more in it than you would put in. So my 4 minute videos or 5 minute videos have almost as much content as I would do in a 15 minute sermon. But in a 15 minute sermon, I would fill it out with, you know, just a little bit more space, a little bit more repetition, and a little bit more usage, maybe one or two extra anecdotes or examples in a sermon. But basically, the arc of a sermon and the arc of a lectionary video are pretty similar in terms of how much of an idea I'm going to be able to get across. But I'm just going to do it really fast in 5 minutes because, you know, on the internet, it's fast.
Yeah.
Also,
go ahead.
The last thing I'd probably say is key on the internet in terms of maintaining your audience is you got to have you got to have some kind of reference or connection which they're going to connect with, which is part of the pop culture constantly. So, you know, I reference Star Wars or this video that's going to go up today is going to have is going to be referencing Amanda Palmer, who I don't know if you know who she is.
Oh, but yeah, The Art of Asking.
Yeah.
Everybody's telling me I need to read that book.
Oh, it's so good. It really is good. So yeah.
Okay. Did you read that, or do you like have an audiobook version of it? Because people to me have raved about the audiobook version of it.
I read it because I'm a text guy. I know I'm making videos, but I love reading. So
okay, all right, yeah. I'm terrible about the amount of reading that I do. It's not enough, and we can get into that later maybe. But I'm sorry. You were saying you're going to put up a video today about the Amanda Palmer book.
It's referencing a recent song she did and talking a little bit about the book. But yeah, just her ideas are all circling in the same vein, in the same area. So it definitely relates to what she's talking about in the book.
So she's a popular figure. That's a well-known book. So you're mm-hmm. connecting that to what you're talking about in your video. And you're saying that you got to do that to make a successful online video. It has to have some larger cultural point of reference.
Yep. Absolutely. Okay. If I was just talking about scripture, I would be really limiting my audience. If all I talked, I mean, obviously, it's following the lectionary. It's very scriptural every week. It has to be because that's where my expertise is. That's where I think I can speak authentically as someone who has something to say that, you know, if I'm going to ask for 5 minutes of your time, I ought to have some good reason why it's worth your 5 minutes.
Right.
But if I were only talking about scripture, I would really limit my audience.
Okay. And it is it's a visual medium because it's video. So mm-hmm. you've obviously built in some visual pieces to it that catch your attention. The green wall.
Yep.
I have to ask you, did you paint the wall green for the videos or was it already green?
We have a green wall in our living room, and I just knew that I wanted to, you know, I was like, I have to film in my house because I don't have money to build a set, and I have to find a space. So I did move some stuff around, some of the pictures around to it, but we have a green wall in our house, so.
Well, it's almost like green screen. I expect, like, the mm-hmm. background to change to, I don't know, you know, the Eiffel Tower or something at some point.
Yeah, Stacia said you better be careful and leave those pictures up because if I actually just had a blank green wall, then people on the internet could just take it and just green screen whatever they wanted in. And
maybe you make that a contest, like put Eric in the most interesting place.
That's right.
Some trolls might not be very generous with that.
But that's amusing too, right? You know, so you gotta be able to laugh at yourself.
Have you had any of that yet? I noticed some comments on one of the videos seemed very constructive and people were engaging, but have you had any haters or trolls on the videos you put up yet?
I have not on the YouTube channel itself. I have on Reddit. So I've posted each week. I post a video on Reddit as well to try and drive some traffic there and to generate some conversation. But the Reddit Christian subreddit and the religion subreddit, less the religion subreddit, but the Christianity subreddit is pretty contentious space. Like, it's pretty combative in general. Like, if you post anything, there'll generally be some debate on the subject. But it's also got a fair number of atheists that hang out in the Christian subreddit, and like sort of engage these things in fairly combative ways. So I've had some kind of negative comments there. Nothing that I would say was out and out trolling yet. No one has been just really needlessly cruel, but there have been some comments like, you know, oh well, my video a couple weeks ago was on the Fault in Our Stars, and I talked about some the fault in our stories, ways that stories are not perfect, and then how we still get meaning out of imperfect stories. Right. And they said, well, if you acknowledge that scripture is imperfect, why are you bothering being Christian anyway? And a bunch of people are like, why don't you just give up on Christianity because it's all flawed and imperfect? And I'm like, you kind of missed the whole point of the video, that imperfect things are still beautiful, right?
Exactly. That's why I'm a Christian, is because it's flawed and imperfect, right?
Right.
Well, the Reddit thing is interesting to me because I've never stepped foot in Reddit, and I don't know much. I know next to nothing about Reddit. The most I learned about Reddit was back in the fall when I was listening to the Serial podcast. Mm-hmm. And like the Reddit threads about that kind of became a story in and of themselves, and people were talking about Reddit on podcasts and things. But what's different about that space? What's Reddit for that YouTube itself is not?
Yeah. So, I mean, what Reddit does extremely well that no other space I've found yet does is it just condenses and collates links from around the internet and sorts them by what's interesting to the hive mind, to the crowd. The basic way it does is when you post a link on Reddit, it appears in the new queue, and people looking through the new queue either vote it up or vote it down based on how interesting it is to them. So you're supposed to, following what the Reddit, following the proper behavior on Reddit, you're supposed to only vote up or down based on whether or not you think that the post is it is informative or interesting in a general sense. You're not supposed to criticize it. It's not supposed to be an agree or disagree button.
Okay.
But of course, you know, that's hard to gauge whether people are following that. But basically what it does do really well is just that it's like a sifter. It just sifts out all the really most interesting things and puts them up there. And it has, and so it's very good at generating conversation.
And you're posting links to your videos on Reddit, and then people are voting on them. You're trying to drive traffic to the YouTube videos. Is it working?
Yeah. I mean, I'm still just early days, and I still have a lot of room I'd like to grow. But basically, I the first 2-3 weeks I didn't post any to Reddit, and then I started posting to Reddit, and I more or less saw my traffic double. I went from getting, you know, 150 to 300 views to getting 500 views right away. So
So people who use Reddit actually click on the stuff and look at it for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, the purpose for Reddit, as opposed to, say, on Facebook, you're kind of there to socialize and to talk to other people and stuff. And the problem with Facebook, as increasingly is becoming the problem with Twitter, is the algorithms which make it so that you don't have control over what you see. Right. On Reddit, the content that you see is always the most popular content rated by the users in exact order of popularity. So you can scroll down a linear feed and see exactly the content that is most to least popular on there.
Okay.
In it. So it's very easy to absorb content, very easy to find content. And content is sorted by subreddit, so it's sorted by topic and what interests you. So if you're interested in Christianity or religion, you just can go to that subreddit and just read all those things. If you want to read about music, you go there or whatever. So,
well, it doesn't surprise me that you're using it, because you've been pretty assertive in how you're promoting these videos.
Yeah, I have been. I feel guilty about that, but I also feel like...
Why? Wait. Why do you feel guilty about it?
Yeah, I mean, self-promotion is always a weird thing, right? It's a thing that, the fact that we now live in a place where everyone has these tools to publish for themselves means that everyone's also their own promoter and publisher.
That's right.
Once upon a time, maybe it was harder to get your stuff out there, but also if you did have your stuff out there, you weren't the one primarily being the one promoting yourself. Other people were promoting you. So now everyone gets to put it out there, but now everyone also is their own promoter, and it feels a little bit like bragging or nagging my friends. I try to do it in space it out, or do it in at least somewhat more creative, or I did not repeat myself overly much, but
Sure.
definitely, that's what I got to do. I gotta remind people it's out there,
Well,
and I still
I'm
have.
really interested in this self-promotion piece because almost everybody that I've talked to on this podcast is doing something that needs to be promoted in order for people to find it. And I think all of us, I'm including myself because this podcast is a new project for me and it's got to be promoted as well, right?
Absolutely.
All of us are struggling with that tension that you just described, that we are the authors of a kind of work that we're doing that is not through, say, a congregation that would promote it as part of its programming, but it's or through a publisher even, but it's just our own project, and we want to let people that we know that we're doing it. And that piece about it feels like you're bragging or you're pestering people. I totally get that, but I guess I'm kind of proceeding with the thought that this is going to be the new norm. I think everybody, not just people who make YouTube videos and podcasts and whatever else, but anybody who's doing any kind of meaningful work is going to have to be able to tell people about it in an assertive public way, right?
Right, absolutely. I mean, I published a book last year with the other two gentlemen on Two Friars and a Fool,
Right.
and that involved a lot of promotion. Still does. I'm trying to do some speaking on it and stuff, and so that it still does. And I noticed that of the three of us, I was the most vocal, the least uncomfortable with it, I guess I should say, in doing it. And that, I think some of it's personality, some of it's are you extroverted? Are you okay with sort of humiliating yourself? Are you willing? What's your threshold for your willingness to sort of kind of gently annoy people?
Yeah. Well, but if you do it, if you build up a body of work, that is its own promotion over time, right?
Exactly.
People will engage with you and with what you're saying and what you're creating because they've interacted with your work before. So, I mean, you're doing these on a weekly basis, right?
Yep.
So it'll be interesting to see over time, you're building an audience.
Right.
Maybe the pressure to be really assertive in promoting it goes down a little bit over time because the audience starts to promote it for you. Isn't that how that's supposed to work?
That's what I hope. Absolutely. I mean, for example, every new subscription I get on YouTube is more or less a new view I'll get on each video. So the first video, I had no guaranteed views. Every view I got was someone I had to persuade to watch it.
Yeah.
But the second video, I had 40 subscribers or whatever. So I got 40 views already, and then anyone else I could persuade, and so on and so forth. Now I'm up to like 85 subscribers. So each video will hopefully have 85 built-in views, and so each time it gets hopefully a little bit easier to do that, and those people help me by themselves sharing it with their friends and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
I mean, and the more important than this all, I mean, self-promotion is something everyone, if you make something, you have to do it. It's just sort of part of the job. But it is less important than making good stuff. And anyone on YouTube, the Vlogbrothers, John and Hank Green say this, all the YouTubers say the most important thing to make to success on YouTube is just making good content.
Right.
Just keep making good content. It took them 100 and some videos before they blew up and were huge. They were like at their 150th video before they really went huge.
And the difference is that that content is public. I mean, you're making that content and exposing it to the entire internet world in real time. You're not keeping it to yourself and then deciding, okay, this is good enough that now I can publish it. You're publishing it all the time. That's kind of at the heart of the project.
Right, absolutely, and it stays up there. And I mean, a video could be a small or moderate success on when it first comes out, or completely fail when it first comes out. But then a couple months later, for whatever reason, it could pick up, take off, and get a bunch of views for some reason. Someone tweets it or shares it that has a bunch of followers, and it does. So it isn't going away. It's going to stay there. It continues to be a potential entry point for people who are interested in the topic. And because I'm trying to, I'm talking about pop culture, which is somewhat sort of time-bound in that it's referencing things which are there, but I try to reference things which are pretty broadly popular and probably have some staying power. Sure. But also, it's following the lectionary. So I'm assuming and hoping that the videos will remain relevant for quite a while, because if you're interested in that particular scripture passage is going to come up at least every 3 years, but it's also
once every 3 years. Yeah,
at least once every 3 years is going to come up and be directly relevant again. A lot of these passages actually come up more often than that.
Right. Was that the main reason that you chose to make it lectionary based? Was that it would have some staying power?
The initial choice to make it lectionary based was, again, it's, I mean, I've preached weekly for 6 years, 7 years. I know the scripture fairly well. It's an expertise I have that I can share. And it's also, it's a pattern that a bunch of other people are following, so there's a built-in audience. So staying lectionary-based was a way for me to say, hey, pastors out there who are trying to write sermons and looking for a little inspiration, this is going to be different than any other lectionary resource out there. It's not going to, you know, a lot, everyone has, like, you know, Feasting on the Word or some other commentary. They don't need more of that. So here's me giving something that's unlike what else is out there for them as some possible sermon fodder, but also for like small group studies and churches or things like that might want to study the lectionary. It's just a pattern which is broadly followed and is helpful because it covers a lot of breadth in scripture. So
yeah, that's interesting. And the structure of the lectionary, you have a choice that you have to make every week because there's multiple texts. So are you following a narrative thread for a while, like doing the gospel text for several weeks and then doing the epistle text, or are you just kind of picking one every week?
I would like to follow narrative threads much more. The lectionary in Lent actually makes that kind of hard because it jumped. It's normally, this is your B, it should be Mark, but it's jumping back and forth between Mark and John every week. I have been confining myself so far to sticking with the gospel for two reasons. One is I actually, as a preacher, prefer the B texts. I tend to preach the Old Testament texts or the epistles just because I like to dig into the sort of thorny things that aren't the main stories that everyone knows. But and so I wanted to do something which for me was actually the unusual choice for me, but also because I know that the gospel text is the one that is the most likely to be referenced or used. And so, you know, I just want to speak to the thing that has the greatest chance of being relevant to different congregations.
So are you still preaching in a congregational setting?
I am not serving a congregation right now, so I am preaching, but as pulpit supply. So I have this Sunday I'm at Milwaukee Presbyterian Church, and then I'll be at Capitol Hill Methodist after that. I'm just kind of rotating around, and I don't end up preaching every Sunday. I end up preaching about twice a month.
Okay. Is that helpful to you? I would imagine that would be kind of helpful in the lectionary project to kind of keep your preacher instinct sharp, because you are preaching in these videos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that I you know, I have an ulterior motive. I like to preach. And so keeping my preaching instincts sharp by staying active in the church is important to me. Even when I don't preach, I find a congregation to be with on a Sunday so that I can absorb some preaching. And actually, for the first time in 7 years, I'm getting to hear a lot more preaching, which is helpful to me as well.
Yeah.
But it works both ways. Part of the reason for lectionary was once I left my congregation in Colorado to move here to Portland. We love it here in Portland. Because of my wife's job, we moved here. I needed an outlet for that I needed to scratch that itch. I wanted I longed to be in the pulpit more. And so lectionary in a way was a way for me to exercise those muscles of digging into the scripture, finding meaning, connecting it with references and resources, and kind of in a fun way with lectionaric.
Yeah.
In the church, I've often found, because of the demographics of Presbyterian church or demographics of basically all church, the references I'm able to make are a different set of references. They're an older demographic. They don't share a lot of the same pop culture milieu as me. Like I have particular, a particular set of stories and movies and things that are of my generation that don't relate to a lot of the people in the church. So when preaching in the church, I actually have to do a lot more of references which are not pop culture references, which are, relating to daily life type references or work references or family references or things like that, which are great. But it's fun to do something different. It's fun to be like, you know what, I'm going to reference Firefly because, right. You know what, I don't care if I don't have to worry about whether or not my octogenarians in the pews will understand it because right. I'm doing something that's more liberated by being able to be on the internet.
And what's really interesting to me about that is that we talk a lot about the church and Christianity as a whole in the North American context needing to find a different footing among, I don't know, some people say millennials, some people say the internet age, whatever you want to call it, right? And you're actually making something that is generating conversation and connection in a digital space among that group of people, right?
Mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting to see what you learn. I mean, you've already described some things you've learned about the Christian subreddits,
yeah,
and how that actually works.
Yeah.
But I'll be interested to hear you talk about like what you're learning about conversations with folks in that space. You're encountering atheists in large numbers, it sounds like, around mm-hmm. the messages in these videos, which if you're preaching to a congregation every week, you're not having those conversations.
Right. Which interestingly to me, one of the things I'd had a conversation with some friends about preaching and what its role was in the church and how and why we do it and speaking as someone who loves preaching and deeply values the craft and the habit and the ritual of it, I think that it's kind of ironic that basically almost all preaching occurs in the context of the deeply enculturated faithful already, which in a way we're all kind of constantly preaching to the choir, and by that I don't mean it's futile or that we don't have as Christians ongoing spiritual development or moral development or all sorts of other things that we need encouragement for and that preaching is useful for. But if you look at the New Testament, most preaching actually occurs like on the street among non-believers or among mixed crowds of believers and non-believers. And I find it interesting that the context of preaching in the New Testament seems to me to be very different from the context of preaching in the church most of the time. And so to me, this is interesting because this is an opportunity for me to put stuff out there which is intentionally not confining itself to the church and aiming to be, let's have a broader conversation with people who are interested in these subjects either because they're critical of them, because they're atheist or agnostic, or they're hostile to religion, or because they're curious but unsure, or because they come from other traditions.
Yeah.
I had an interesting conversation. One of the guys who got in a long conversation with me on Twitter about the Wall Street video I talked about usury and stuff in the video. He was Muslim and he was thrilled to hear a Christian talking about usury as a sin. He had never heard that, which says something I think about maybe Christian preaching and the way we witness about things, because it's Christians have historically thought usury was a sin, but this Muslim had no idea that that was a Christian position or a possible Christian position.
Wow.
And yet it's a very strong tradition in Muslim tradition. So he was thrilled by it. And he's like, but if you think this, why do you think that, and then we got into stuff like the divinity of Jesus. Cause he's like, if you're right about usury, why would you be so wrong about Jesus?
How do you answer that?
All right. I mean, that's awesome to have that conversation at all.
Yeah,
that
it is.
Could never happen if I was preaching in a church, right? That could never happen if I was preaching in a church.
No, it couldn't. And it couldn't even happen if you just took the sermon that you preached in the church and put it online. It really takes something that has the internet as its primary audience.
Right, absolutely.
Which is what you're doing.
Right.
And this was a conversation that happened on Twitter.
On Twitter, yeah.
Did you know this guy before?
No, never met him before, and now he's a subscriber, so we'll see what he thinks of my other videos, because I don't know how much overlap there will be, but yeah, I mean, he's like, why are you so wrong about Jesus? And I said, well, obviously, as a Christian, this is going to be a principal point of departure between you and me on this, but I will say this, I hold that Jesus is the full revelation of God, but not the sole revelation of God. So if you want to talk to me about the ways that you understand God, I would be thrilled to hear what you have to say about your experience of God. And so then he was all excited about wanting to talk about, you know, Allah and how he knows Allah, which is awesome. So,
well, it comes back to that thing earlier about having the gospel stories or the Christian story critiqued from the standpoint of an alternative story.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. I
mean, very rarely do we actually sit with people who are either not Christian or adherents of another faith tradition and listen to them describe for us what they see in our faith and in the gospel story and hear that perspective on it, which is, it seems like these videos are providing a door for you to do that. That's fascinating.
So far they are, and I hope they continue to maybe even more so do that.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the book that you wrote earlier, and you've mentioned Two Friars and a Fool a little bit. That's something that you've kind of been known for in churchy internet circles for a while. But this is, if I'm not mistaken, this is the first thing that you've kind of gone out and said, all right, this is me, this is Eric. I mean, your name's in the title. This is my thing. Is that a little bit nerve-wracking, or are you kind of thrilled by that?
I mean, both. I hate looking at myself on video or hearing my voice in recording. I think that that's a universal self-conscious experience of most people. So it's nerve-wracking to put something out there that I care about, that I work hard at. I really do work hard on these things, and I know that there's lots of room for growth in. So there's that experience when you make something of it. You know in your head what you want it to be like, and your skill to be able to make it that way hasn't quite grown to your vision, and so there's that growing edge, which is always uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But that would, I would say all of that is less than the excitement I have to be doing this project and to be putting something out there that is that I think is needed. Like, I think, as I said earlier, there's just so little good Christian content on YouTube, I'd like to see more of it. I'd like to encourage other people to take risks and to try and do it. And to do something that is that is mine, you know, that other people can look at and like or dislike, but it is it's there's no outside creative control. Like, it's me. I sit down, I come up with the ideas, I write the ideas, I perform the script, I, you know, look it over. Everything about it is you know, what I can come up with and put out. I have a friend who's helping me do the editing and learn the editing side of it there, but we talk really extensively about what we want the videos to be like.
Well, the first one, I mean, you had the idea. I'm sure you had the idea for a long time before you actually did it. Is that a safe assumption?
Yes.
So what was the thing that pushed you to finally do it?
I mean, what pushed me to finally get the whole project going is just the fact that, you know, I think that if I want to be in ministry, church-related ministry, for a lifelong career, I have to be innovative, creative. I have to be making my own stuff, because the church, because of the obvious problems, the church declining, the numbers of pulpits available going down, the pay decreasing, all those sorts of things, and because of the fact that the old models, it's not just that the opportunities are decreasing, but that the old ways and models of doing church are not thriving, and there's other ways, there's other things that we need to try for the sake of you know, faithful risk and doing ministry in a way that is faithful to our context. So you sat with that reality
for a long time. Was there like some precipitating thing that made you say, all right, now's the time, I'm doing this now?
The precipitating thing that's now the time is doing us now was the, you know, the combination of time and ability. I mean, I had written scripts for them, for a couple of them, like a few months ago. I'd been debating with myself about it, and finally it was just like, you know what? The beginning of Lent is a good time to start. It's a, you know, a clean break in this liturgical seasons. It's a good space for me to be on there, and we can build up some recorded footage and scripts ahead of time so that we're ready to go and launch. So I mean, yeah, I just looked at the calendar and said, I'm going to do this. Pick a date that makes sense, and let's do it.
And you've kept doing it. You've got what, four in the can.
Another one goes up today, and we're actually a little behind this week for external reasons, but we have one that'll go up right now today, and then another will go up at the end of this week.
Right.
And then there'll actually be two next week, because in addition to the normal lectionary video, I'm releasing a music video, which I am simultaneously excited about and terrified of.
Like an original musical composition?
Yeah, well, it's based on an Amanda Palmer song, so I mention it in the video about Amanda Palmer today.
Okay.
It's based on an Amanda Palmer song, but I wrote entirely new lyrics and had a friend who plays guitar, and we sat down together and redid a new accompaniment. So it's got the core of some of an Amanda Palmer song in it, and it references that Amanda Palmer song, but it's sort of its own thing.
Are you singing on it?
Yeah, I'm singing on it.
That's awesome. That's terrifying, but it's awesome.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to do something similar. This podcast is a little project. It's not a big deal, but I think maybe there was a similar process for the two of us, and I thought about doing something like this for a really long time before I actually said, all right, I'm just going to do it. And if it's a failure, then it's a failure and fine. But what kind of things do people need to finally feel the confidence to create work like this? Because I think you're totally right. And I was at the Next Church conference last week, and that's like 600 people in the Presbyterian Church who are, you know, looking for new and creative ways to be in the church in the world. And I think the reality you just described is a really succinct, really accurate way to put the situation that we're in that, you know, the call situation for pastors and for people who feel called to ministry is not getting any better. It's not going to get any better in terms of the availability of calls and the pay and all that sort of thing. But not just that, but the model itself is not thriving anymore, and there need to be new creative expressions of a Christian voice in the culture. And I'm convinced that there's a ton of people out there in the Presbyterian Church and lots of other church traditions who have really cool ideas, but who are sort of stymied by, you know, maybe it's that thing that we talked about earlier about self-promotion, and that seems sort of wrong somehow. But that's why I asked you, what got you to finally do it? And it sounds like you had more of like internal motivation where it finally was just the right time. There wasn't like an event or a person who just kind of like pushed you over. Mm-hmm. But don't you think there's a lot of people out there who have similar ideas and we just don't feel like we have the permission to do it yet?
Yeah, I definitely do. In fact, one of the big themes of the Unconference that I've been a part of as a host for the last few years, don't get a host it this year, but I'm going to be cheering them on while they meet in New York in May, is that is giving people permission that you don't, you know, just saying, you have permission. That idea you've been thinking of, that dream you've had, that vision, that goal you've planned, that there's no official body, there's no, you know, critical imprimatur, there's no, like, bureaucratic red tape, there's nothing in the way of you pursuing most any dreams and goals that you might want to, other than, you know, your own inhibitions. So go for it. You know, I think that's a big I think that's a big step, a big encouragement people need. And in some ways, it's pretty revolutionary to our time period. It's always, to a degree, been true that you should just pursue and try and create things. But the fact that the tools for distributing the things you create are so are freely available right now is
anybody can use them. Yeah,
historically unprecedented. It is amazing.
Right. I do this podcast with a Chromebook using YouTube videos and online editing software. I don't have any computer software, no Final Cut or Audacity even, or whatever you'd, or is that the audio?
Audacity, yeah, Audacity, and Audacity is free even, so it wouldn't be that big a deal to download Audacity and do it.
But the point is, the tools are out there, and they're available to anybody.
Right, they're available to anybody. They're not that hard to learn.
And there's tutorials online. I mean, I've learned how to do. I learned that you could do this with YouTube, with Google Hangouts on air, just with a simple Google search. Right, like how do you record a Google Hangout, and it was right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let me ask you about the Unconference just really quickly. Who do I talk to about that? Because who's hosting it? I would love to talk to them on the podcast about that event.
Yeah, probably the person that would be a great spokesperson for that would be Carol Howard Merritt.
Right, right.
And also involved as host this year, Michael Gyra, who is he runs Worship Times. He's a web designer, programmer, also a Princeton grad.
Cool.
He's the chair of their board. I could easily put you in touch with them, but yeah, those would be people I would talk to, and I think that they would love to talk to you about.
Yeah, that'd
Unco.
Be great.
And there is a West Coast Unco in fall.
Right, that's up in San Francisco, right?
Up in San Francisco, yeah.
Yeah, I've never been to one of those. They've always looked really interesting and really intriguing, but sort of because the people connected to them seem to me to be really creative, outgoing people. It's a little intimidating.
Understood, yeah. I mean, I think the thing about Unco is I went to Next Church last year, and it's a lot like Next Church, but just less programming, more intimate, and more, relational. It's the same idea. Let's come up with new ideas. Let's inspire the church. Let's go in new directions, but let's just do it in a more intimate setting, in a more personal one-to-one kind of way, and without the programming. It's done by the attendees and the people who are there.
Which is why it's called an unconference.
Right, which is why it's called an unconference.
Yeah, I was one of the co-chairs of the Next Church conference this year, and we had a lot of programming.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even so, you know, we had an entire afternoon on Tuesday that we just kind of left open. There were some off-site workshops and stuff, and even just having that afternoon, people were like, the feedback we got was great from people, like, we really needed that time.
Mm-hmm.
Because... yeah, you sort of reach a capacity after a while. I did that event, and then right after that, in the same space, was the Progressive Youth Ministry Conference that I went to.
Right.
And by like the end of the first day of that event, I was done mentally. Like I was just I couldn't take in anymore.
Right.
And that was that was a great conference.
Yeah, I mean, I think both are valid, and I've enjoyed both expressions of you know, conferences and getting together. But I think that what's really cool about the Unconference is that it's a sort of act of trust. It's a kind of trust fall to say, we're going to get together with a group of people. We do not know who these people necessarily are. We might know some of them beforehand, but we don't, you know, it's a different group each year. We don't necessarily know who these people are, and we don't know what the programming is going to be because it's going to be decided when we get there among those people. And so it's very much an act of trust of saying, let's just go and see what this generates. And I've done it 5 years, 6 years, and every single time it has been astoundingly productive. Like, lots has come out of that conversation. And I think the lesson is just that there's a lot more creativity and a lot more energy and a lot more expertise out there than we ever give ourselves credit for, because we're always expecting or looking for that to come from, you know, official channels or from outside voices or from people who've published books or who have some sort of credentials that indicate that they're the ones that can express expertise or knowledge or creativity.
Well, and Carol is one of those people. She's written books. She writes for the Christian Century. She has those kind of credentials.
Absolutely, absolutely. But at Unco, she's just one of the group. She doesn't, you know, she doesn't have like a formal speaker role. She's one of the group, and she contributes ideas. And that's awesome to be in that sort of environment where you're like, this person who I just met, who's a candidate for ministry, contributes an idea and it has is given equal weight by the group as something that Carol Howard Merritt contributes, who's, you know, published several books and has a column on Christian Century.
Yeah, it sounds like something I really need to get to. You said the West Coast one is in the fall?
It's in the fall. It's in October, I think.
Yeah, that would be fascinating. I would love to be a part of that. Okay, so let me ask you one last little thing, because we're at about an hour, and that's how much time I said I was going to take. I'm really interested in the technical components of what you're doing. It's pretty well edited. These videos are snappy. It's the little editing where you're from on one side of the screen and then it cuts to the other side. I just have to know how you do that. Do you record several versions and splice them together, or do you just move in the same shot and then edit out the delay?
Right. So the brilliance of it is that it's actually really pretty easy to do. So what I do when I record is I set my camera up and I put it on record, and then I have the script off to the side. So I read the script, the line, and I say the line like three or four times into the camera, sometimes doing it in different positions, sometimes different expressions or whatever. But usually I kind of know how I want that line to look. So I'll say that line, and I'll say that line several times until I'm sure I've got a good take of it. And then I read the next line and I do it. And it's all one, the camera just keeps recording. And so I do the next line, and then I do the next line, and then I do the next line. In between lines, I'll move around, so I'll be in different positions for different lines, or, you know, and I usually pick things. Like, I have a thought in my mind. This spot is the spot I'm going to use in the shot when I'm doing a sort of explanatory discursive. This spot is the spot I'm going to use when I'm doing, like, a jokey line aside to the audience. And this spot is the spot I'm going to use when I'm saying something really emotionally interesting or powerful. And I might break it up in different ways. But basically, I have thoughts about how I want to use the space on the screen. And I say the lines. I move around in the camera. It's all one long recording. And it usually comes out to be like 25, 30 minutes. And then we sit down with that and my friend Andrew, who's editing it, and we just go through and we pick out the best cuts. He does most of the work. He picks out the best cuts of the lines and cuts them together. And with jump cuts, you want to be as, you know, like I say, no silence. So he cuts right to the moment I'm speaking on each line, leaving very little air.
It's that thing about silence on the internet. You can't have it.
You can't have it.
So call those jump cuts, yeah?
Yeah, jump cuts. Or I guess more better than saying you can't have silence on the internet is that silence on the internet is like exponentially more powerful than it is elsewhere. And so if you're going to use silence, be very intentional about how you use it and use it just right at the right times. Like this video I just recorded last night, it will have some silence in it toward the end because of emotional impact I want the to have there. But But the silence will be less than I would use in a sermon, and it will be only at that point when I'm like, I'm ready for this emotionally to really hit home.
Right.
Silence is just really powerful. So
if there's a no silence rule on the internet, it makes me think of that rule that I've heard in connection with, I heard a trainer for Godly Play, which is a biblical storytelling model, say this: know the rules well enough to break them effectively.
Exactly.
And that sounds kind of like what you're doing.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you've got a camera. What kind of camera are you using?
It's a Canon PowerShot.
So it's a video recorder. It's not a computer. You're not using a cell phone. You're using a real video camera.
Yeah. It's a DSLR. So it does video and still shots. It does slow-mo. It's not a super fancy one. It's about $180 camera, but it's a camera, not using a laptop webcam or anything.
And you got a microphone connected to it.
Uh-huh.
And you're editing it with what kind of software?
So Andrew, who's doing the editing, he's on a Mac, so he's using not iMovie. What's the Pro.
Final Cut.
Final Cut. There you go. Final Cut. That's right? It.
Okay. So are you learning the editing so that it's just going to be you eventually?
That is very likely how it's going to turn out. Andrew's a professional. He has his own life and job to do. I don't think he'll want to do this for me forever as a friend. And so I am learning it and hoping that I can take over and do that at some point. But I know,
you couldn't ask for a better teacher.
Yeah.
Than somebody who does that professionally.
Absolutely.
That's terrific. So last question. The pictures on the wall behind you, what in the heck are those?
Those are Art Nouveau prints of characters from Firefly, the television show, Serenity, the movie. So those are the characters from that show, but done in an Art Nouveau style. So it's got the...
Yeah. Well, they're very engaging visually. I keep looking at them wondering, is that some... I mean, I don't know Firefly or that series at all, but maybe I would recognize them if I did. But they're right. Cool. I like them. They add a nice effect.
It's sort of an Easter egg.
It's a cool setup you have.
Yeah, and I feel like you want to have something in the shot that's visually dense and interesting so that, you know, people who are bored with looking at my face can find something interesting to look at.
Well, it's really interesting to look at. It's interesting to listen to. They're thought-provoking. They're following all those rules of internet video that you talked about really well. And I look forward to them, and I'm watching every single one, and I'm going to embed one of them on my website where I put this podcast. Can I just take my pick, or is there one that you really think if people are going to see one who've never seen it before, they should see?
Oh, take your pick with, because I'm not sure, I have one coming out today, and I don't know how long it'll take you to get this one up, but so...
I've been putting these up on Thursdays.
Great, so you'll have at least one more option by the time you get this up, so...
All right, terrific. Well, listen, I really love what you're doing, and I appreciate you taking the time. I really enjoyed this conversation. I learned a lot.
Yeah, I enjoyed this a lot as well. Thank you for inviting me, and I hope to catch up with you. Maybe I'll see you at UNCO.
Yeah, let's hope so.
Mm-hmm.
All right, see you, Eric. Thanks.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.